This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more at robertaspizza.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're telling the stories behind iconic dishes. We learn what it will take to save New York's most famous egg cream, discover the importance of the goat neck in the East Village, and take a trip to India for delicious flatbreads.
Our customers who come in to get egg creams and t-shirts, they love to talk about their childhood or their teenage years or their college years.
I was living in Nepal, in northern India. And out there, there's a real famous dish, a classic dish, I should say, is called paya.
Parathe wali gali, or as it awkwardly translates in English, the lane of the stuffed flatbread makers, is probably one of the most popular food streets in Old Delhi.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coral Lee. Following her studies of both Chinese and Indian history at SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London, Mukta Das's research interests have continued to exist at the intersection of South and East Asian cuisine and culture. Mukta has been following a group of South Asians who have adopted Cantonese cities and cultural and culinary identities, and we're here to talk about the complexities of heritage making as an outsider in a country already confused and split between rejecting and accepting values of the central government. Welcome to the show, Mukta.
Thank you so much, Carl.
So you are here for what?
Oh, wow. Well, I'm here to support my friend who is running the New York Marathon. Go, Alan. I'm sure he's probably already finished by now. But so we're here as a group of friends and we're kind of cheering him on, and making sure he has his runs his best race.
Yeah, this is definitely the episode I've planned the most in advance. We started talking like a year or
that's
6 months ago.
Right, that's
quite
right.
A while ago. So yeah. This has felt like... very
incubated.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, as I was explaining to Mukta before the show, we've had a lot of SOAS alum on this show, and I've always assumed it was just School of Arts and Science, but I found on Wikipedia right before this episode that it's actually School of African and Oriental Studies. Mm. So why is it called that, and why is it still called that?
Yes, I know. I mean, it sounds like quite an archaic name, doesn't it? And so I think it's based on the history of the place. So it was founded in the 1910s as a way of training colonial administrators in the British government to learn the language, whether it was Chinese or Hindi, and then basically to travel out there and be a part of the British Empire and run things from there. So it's definitely rooted in colonial history, hence the Oriental and African Studies kind of moniker. But I think we're kind of moving away from that. We've got a huge decolonial agenda. So I think we're more comfortable calling ourselves SOAS, so the acronym as a kind of name. Kind of a nod to the history, but also a kind of flag in the ground to say we're moving forward.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the modernized name should be if you could rename the school?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. Definitely drop the Oriental. Don't you think?
Right?
Yeah. That's a random way of calling a region. I'm not really sure. I think regionally we're strong there. We're still strong in China and India and Southeast Asia and East Asia. And of course, we've got really good scholarship in Africa. So I don't have a problem with naming the regions, but maybe drop the Oriental.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's start by just talking about your research. What sparked this interest in this kind of convergence between South and East Asian cuisine and culture, which is not something that most people think about?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, it's always, I'm sure you know, Carl, it's always a personal voyage, a PhD like this. And so, you know, I'm a child of an immigrant family. My family just happened to come from South Asia to Europe. But what I decided to do was follow a lot of the new immigrants moving from South Asia across to the East, to China in particular, because actually what they were articulating to me at the time and constantly really is the fact that they wanted to take a slice of the China dream. This idea.
Wait, what is the China dream?
Exactly, right? So this big amorphous thing that not even they could really fully articulate, but this idea that actually China's this massive emerging superpower, that there was an opportunity to be had, money to be made, names to be generated, brands to be suddenly launched. There's this idea that the axis of cultural power had shifted from Europe and America straight into China. And so they wanted to do that. They wanted to build restaurant empires. They wanted to expand out of places like Hong Kong and Macau and Guangzhou and Beijing and basically launch globally. And that was a dream of theirs. And so, so I wanted to kind of mark that really and research it, make, you know, kind of look at it more deeply and see what kind of, what kind of everyday lives people led with this big dream to be had.
Yeah. When was this migration happening? Was it happening kind of in tandem with like the American dream, or is it kind of post-American dream?
It's a little bit of both. So right now there's a huge amount of migration, and I guess it's about, maybe there's an idea that America and Europe are kind of closed and to certain types of investment, certain types of migration. And so I guess at the moment it's a kind of post-American migratory channel. But actually South Asians have been finding themselves in Hong Kong and Macau in the southern part of China for centuries. So there's an idea that actually what they're doing is layering on top of this historical route and finding their kind of place in a history of South Asian migration. You know, they're finding their kind of meaning in that. And so, yes, it's new, and it feels like actually, you know, we have to move away from Europe and America as the land of opportunities. But also, we've always been heading east. We've always been looking east. And both things are true for people who are, you know, trying to make a life there.
Yeah, and is it reciprocal? Are there a lot of Chinese people moving to South Asia, or is it mostly one way?
There are, I didn't really research that much, but from the stories that I heard and the friends that I made in China, a lot of people have been visiting India. There's a huge movement to understand and to practice yoga. And so that has resulted in a lot of yoga tourism from China to India and other reasons too. So there is a great deal of interest right now. And of course, from the late 1800s throughout the 1900s, there's been a lot of Chinese migration into Chinatowns in India too. So we have a number of bustling Chinatowns, especially in Calcutta. Mm-hmm. So it's been, again, there's this idea of there's a historical layering which sort of underpins all the new movements that people are going on now.
Mm-hmm. So back to what you were saying or about your PhD being kind of a personal voyage. In my internet stalking of you, I also saw that you did this kind of culinary series with Chef Andrew Wong. So can you talk about that and what that was all about?
So part of my PhD was all about trying to find, I guess, kind of what we mean by Indian and what we mean by Chinese food. And a lot of it's not, I mean, we can assume we know what we mean, but as you can't find an origin story for a Chinese dish. You know, it's sort of shrouded in mystery. But, you know, there are lots of historical research, lots of historical sources that look at recipes. And so I've looked at both sides, Indian and Chinese historical recipes, and Andrew and I were in touch via Twitter for several years because I was posting some random things on, historical Chinese recipes from the Tang Dynasty, or, you know, from 1,000 years ago and things like this. And he picked up on that because he's really focused on unearthing historical techniques and ingredients and skills to try and see if he can replicate those in his very modern London tiny family sort of kitchen. And so we've been working together over the last few years kind of trying to find a practical use for some of this, largely poetry. Actually, chefs weren't really writing recipes down, but poets were and scholars were. And so we've been trying to kind of unpick some of this beautiful prose to look at what these things actually meant in the kitchen. You know, what kind of tastes were produced by combining these things together. We've been kind of messing around, I think would probably be the best way to describe the research that we've been doing. So part of it's to do with kind of finding a historical basis for understanding what we even mean by these kinds of cuisines that I've been studying in my PhD. And part of it's been a very playful look at how we can kind of, I guess, remix these recipes for a modern kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what have been some of the practical applications of, like as you said, kind of uncovering these moments of prose or poetry and then, you know, seeing them applied in the kitchen?
So we've got about 8 recipes that we've managed to kind of put together, and they're not faithful recreations of fully formed recipes. In fact, there are very few historical sources in China where there are full recipes available. So it's about sort of looking at a particular dynastic period, like the Tang Dynasty or the Song Dynasty, and looking at all sorts of historical sources, you know, agricultural records, what was traded in and around China, and then looking at some of the prose and trying to put together things that kind of make sense into a dish that tells the story of a dynastic period, if you like. So it's more of a portrait of something. And so we've been looking at the Silk Road in particular and how that morphed and changed over the centuries. And so we've put together dishes that look at how viticulture was introduced into China through the Silk Road. So there are recipes with, you know, with kebabs and grapes and things that kind of celebrate the Central Asian influence into China during that time. Mm. So it's largely about sort of layering it and putting together a complicated picture that represents this kind of era, if you like, rather than a faithful recipe, which, you know, are hard to come by and often, because they're written by poets, they're not quite, you know,
right,
replicable.
So in studying the history of both Chinese and Indian cuisines, you're kind of noticing that they're not really so distinct, but like you said, they're very layered and almost hybridized. And so what are there certain patterns that you've seen evolve throughout time? And, you know, where did they diverge, if at all? And yeah, what are some characteristics that each express?
Mm. Well, it's interesting because actually what you have is a land route where these influences were kind of exchanged. So across the deserts, across the Silk Road, what you have are kind of, you know, certain types of meats and spices and breads and wheat and sort of milling and processing and things like this that are quite uniform across that region, including in northwest China, as well as in northern India. And so you have this kind of land route that kind of almost connects the two in a spectrum of wheat and meat. And then you have a kind of maritime route, which basically connects southern India to Southeast Asia and China and slightly beyond. And there it's far more complicated. And this is where I usually focus on, because I'm looking at largely maritime trading and maritime culinary tastes and whatnot. And it's not just, you know, Indian maritime trading empires that would bring sort of, you get this kind of confusion about where certain steamed goods come from, you know, or rice flour, or, you know, the origins of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. They get mixed up in this history. But then you also have these colonial processes, you know, so if they've got Portuguese, the Dutch, the English, they come in and they start to bring in different foods and ideas, which kind of connect Macau to Nagasaki to Malacca, to Malaysia. So you've got these very interesting, again, I guess layered, it's probably my word for the day, layered kind of culinary histories that connect these ports, these kind of very disparate cities and city-states together, that kind of confuse the history a little bit. Mm-hmm. Again, origin stories just don't make any sense when you're trying to plot, you know, where certain things come from and why mm-hmm. people use them and eat them and enjoy them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as you said, the kind of migration of South Asians to East Asian spaces is kind of new-ish. And so if you are, you know, a modern-day South Asian and you are not necessarily well-versed in the history that you speak of, what is your experience when you're moving into these Cantonese spaces? How do you kind of express your own culinary identity? Are you adopting Cantonese tastes?
Hmm. It's an interesting question because actually many a time I was schooled in this history, especially by Tamil restaurateurs who were really keen to say, actually, you know, we had a very prosperous empire from the 1300s and we've been trading with the Cantonese-speaking people or the southern Chinese people for centuries. So we have as much right to be here as anybody else. So you have that kind of attitude, mm-hmm. and then you have this these restaurants that open up, and they have this, you know, they have a kind of a standard Indian menu, you know, of creamy curries and hot spicy tomato based sauces and breads and samosas and things, you know, kind of familiar to people who are just used to eating in certain types of curry houses mm-hmm. in the West, and so there'll be a you know, they'll try and reproduce that there, you know, this kind of Euro-American tradition, this right. ordinary eating, they try and reproduce there. But actually, that doesn't actually work because in Cantonese culture, there's different, you know, there's different ways of ordering food, the different kinds of ways of enjoying restaurant meals, banquets. There's not a history of sort of touching food directly. And there's all sorts of interesting ways that people have to South Asian restaurateurs have to navigate this space. And so sometimes it's unapologetically, okay, this is what we're serving, mm-hmm. you know, we'll find a market. And other times they've introduced different kind of spicing mixtures that you know, they take a masala that, you know, very seed based, very very hot and spicy, and then they'll turn it into something that tastes a lot like five spice, mm. you know, with a lot of sweet fennel and aniseed and all sorts of things. So they'll bring in so these sweet flavors to introduce a kind of what they call a Cantonese masala. Mm. So you have attempts like that to kind of get into the space and to you know, introduce some menus that feel a bit banquety. So they all come together, all the dishes come together at once. And, you know, it's a set menu that you can just order and you can just pick at with rice, you know, rather than have, you know, a starter, a main course and a dessert, as you would find probably here or you would order here right. or in London.
Yeah. That kind of taste adjusting is totally feels not unlike like orange chicken here, right? Or Chinese food had to be kind of like dumbed down a little bit and slowly fed to the masses. And now it's like, oh yeah, I know about regional Chinese food, right?
Yeah.
But so as those South Asian restaurateurs are making these little adjustments, who are those adjustments for? Mm. And what does it kind of mean for the future of the kind of commingling of these cultures?
Mm. I found a lot of these, so I studied this kind of commingling, I guess, in three cities, in Guangzhou, which is in South China, in mainland South China, and then Hong Kong and Macau, which are special administrative territories. And actually what I found with Hong Kong is that a lot of this adjusting, this sweetening, etc., happened since 1997. Hmm. So with a lot of the kind of flight of the British and Europeans from China, from Hong Kong, what you find is restaurateurs going, well, okay, we're not leaving. We're just going to have to adjust. And so there's this idea, actually, and this is probably across the board, I'd say, that actually people are settling in for the long haul. They are not going in and then getting out with as much money as they can. They're sojourning, they're bringing their families, they're, you know, these are multi-generational families, grandkids, etc. And so it feels like they are committing to the region and trying to find better spaces, better culinary expressions of Indian food, looking at game meats, maybe introducing, and some of these restaurateurs who are after Michelin stars in Hong Kong and Macau, they're looking at, you know, maybe introducing VIP menus where they can crack out of the no beef, no pork, very, very safe chicken, fish, kind of lamb, you know, triumvirate, and move into game and other things so they can start to, you know, maybe catch some awards that, you know, that kind of, you know, show them that they're rising in status as much as, you know, as India is, as much as China is. And so, yeah, there's a sense that actually what they're going to be doing is maybe breaking out of the usual curry house menu and using it as a chance to explore meat, I guess,
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what is it about Hong Kong or any of these Cantonese spaces that they're seeing provides the slice of the Chinese dream? I feel like even for people who are native to Hong Kong, find the area and just cultural very fraught right now. It's confusing. Yeah. Are you Chinese? Are you Cantonese? You know, and so it's like there's this another layer here where it's like I'm South Asian entering this place that's neither Cantonese nor Chinese, and how am I to express my culinary identity? Am I South Asian? Am I Cantonese? Am I Chinese?
I mean, these are global cities, and so in many ways you go into, and I'm not saying that from New York you can go to Hong Kong and suddenly things are familiar. That's not the case. But yet there are, you know, a global city is a global city. You know, you have a metro, you have lots of cuisines, you have a walkable path. You know, you get a sense of a city quite quickly because, you know, actually, you know, these spaces are, you know, they're part of sort of the capitalist kind of system, if you like. So, you know, Hong Kong's just as important as anywhere else to launch a brand or to find yourself, you know, find yourself as an entrepreneur. So there is that as well. So beyond the ethno-linguistic identity of the city, it's there to be exploited, if you like. In terms of Cantonese-ness, I guess, that's always, I guess, been in flux. Obviously there's been a lot of more of this kind of exploration, political activism around Hong Kong identity in more recent times. But actually, it's been something that has been always negotiated, even during the early days of the British rule over that island and eventually the new territories. And Indians have tried to find their space in that for a very long time. And there used to be very clear hierarchies on racial lines, right? So you had white Europeans on top, and then you had the Asian Indian administrators, and then you had the Chinese workers or Chinese industrialists and the Chinese workers. You know, there was a very strict, very clear hierarchy. And now, you know, there are still racial hierarchies. Obviously, it's not somehow post-racial. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people are still trying to find their space in this very, very near post-colonial time, right? You know, it's within a generation that this has turned from a British territory into a, you know, a Chinese administered region. So it's within living memory, and I think everything's really in flux. Is race a resource there? I don't know. In Taiwan, you know, they're very keen on saying they're very multicultural, very different from mainland China, because actually they're able to embrace diversity in a way that mainland Chinese, you know, the state hasn't been able to. Does Hong Kong, does Macau do that too? Are they saying, you know, we've got, you know, large populations of non-Chinese who are very happy here, you know, does that mean we're more of a global city than Shanghai or Beijing, for example? You know, that's an interesting question that probably needs a bit more research. And
Yeah, I guess you don't yet have the answers then, but my follow-up question is then, how does immigrants' experience in Hong Kong kind of differ from America?
I'm looking into this a little bit more because you know, this idea that sort of the Euro-American experience is somehow the ordinary experience, you know, that you have an apartment with a certain type of kitchen and a certain kind of supermarket next door and a street that is this and with a metro station. You know, there is a kind of sense that actually, you know, global cities probably deliver that, and actually the experience of an immigrant, whether they're in New York or London or Hong Kong, probably is quite similar. But actually we know that's kind of not true. You know, ordinariness in Hong Kong is very different from ordinariness in New York, as anyone would probably attest if they travel back and forth. And so, you know, there's this idea of contending with space and with land rights and literally physical space, but also with this idea that actually, you know, a territory that is 96%, you know, ethnically Chinese, Cantonese, you know, it's quite monocultural in a way that I think a lot of the European cities or Euro-American cities aren't. And so, you know, there is a sense that actually, you know, if you're going to be visible, you're going to be visible. And I think there's still a sense that actually, you know, Indians are, and I'm talking particularly about Indians here, are, you know, trying to find a way of, I guess, being comfortable with that visibility. And I think recently, you know, with the economic resurgence of India and, you know, the cultural power of Bollywood and, you know, the film industry, the music industry, you know, they're finding ways of kind of expressing themselves in these huge, you know, premium world city spaces, you know, taking up the, you know, this casino hotel with award ceremonies and doing this and doing that. So, you know, they are consumers of Hong Kong as a space too. And I think that's probably what you know, something that's come out quite recently as a result of India being on the resurgence too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in your research, you are kind of looking at how South and East Asian people are kind of more concerned or anxious about heritage making. So can you talk about what that is and what that looks like and how people are finding it now?
Mm. Yeah, it's really interesting because actually when I was researching in Hong Kong from about 2014, there was a great deal of work being done to kind of put together a Hong Kong intangible cultural heritage list. So
yes, I think the steamed Malaysian cake was like one of the items on the list.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And herbal tea,
right,
and milk tea making and all sorts of processed fish products and, mm-hmm, and agricultural foods. And so I think there were about 70 different foods that were on the list of about 480. And this was a huge community effort. I mean, basically the office just sent out loads and loads of questionnaires and they asked all sorts of district councils to just fill them and keep them coming. So they had 480 of these really interesting but sometimes slightly samey festivals. and what they had in the end were these seven South Asian festivals, Diwali, etc., Navratri. And so what they, you know, it was a kind of weird thing where actually, you know, they wanted the community to kind of basically nominate things, and of course they truly encouraged all the ethnic minority communities to nominate things too. Again, this idea that racial diversity is a resource in Hong Kong, right? It's showing that there's a big difference between Hong Kong and Shanghai, for example. But actually, you know, there was also a lot of complicated feelings about including a South Asian festival as Hong Kong intangible cultural heritage, both from the South Asian side, but also from the Cantonese side too, you know? Like, you know, do these things really truly belong in Hong Kong's flora and, you know, in its DNA? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, actually as a community consultation, it was thought of as a complete success because of these seven diverse things that ended up being out there. You know, at the end of the day, it's simply a list that can be rejigged and refined in later years. And I think they sent up 20 to Chinese central government to say, look, this is our 20, this is our Hong Kong 20. And none of the South Asian stuff, you know, survived that culling to 20. So it's been a, you know, and heritage making, okay, it's obviously supposed to be about the past, but we know it's also about the future, right? You know, because actually when you start to say something is heritage, you want to protect it. You want to pass it down the generations. You want it to be a fundamental part of your identity. And so, you know, it's no accident that these heritage projects happened at this time, you know, with this idea that Hong Kong is really trying to find its identity and trying to make its make this identity as crystal clear as possible within this sort of busy regional area, and that a lot of the civil servants who are now very powerful in heritage making and all sorts of other things are, you know, a generation of young civil servants who grew up in the 80s and the 90s who were looking forward to and know nothing but post-colonial Hong Kong, that cared nothing for the British and want Hong Kong to be as kind of culturally coherent as Singapore, for example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a deep, I think, a deep belief that that's possible, that, you know, there's a coherence there and that these Ba Shahol generation, this generation of 80s and onwards, are there to kind of usher this Hong Kong identity to the 21st century and keep it going. You know, that's their legacy. They want to make sure that happens.
Mm-hmm. This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back to more heritage making after this break.
Mm-hmm.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the two Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Join Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th, for a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Join us to explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, where you'll taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Join the party. Tickets are available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
And we're back. And so Mukta and I were talking about, if not the revolutionary kind of interest in heritage making, the at least recently popularized heritage making of Southern and East Asian cultures. Mm-hmm. And so how has this kind of shifted in light of the recent protests? Can you kind of set the stage, like what the protests are about, what Cantonese people want, and what they're not getting, and what this kind of means for heritage making in the future?
Mm. I mean, clearly, there's a sense that actually, since 1997, when the handover happened between Britain and China, there's this there's a 50-year period where Hong Kong is effectively ruled by its own mini constitution, so it's fairly independent from China. And there is a very strong sense that that 50-year period is to be completely protected, and there should be no encroachment on anyone, any side, over Hong Kong, if you like, territorial independence or semi-independence, semi-autonomy. And so Hong Kong people, I think, feel very strongly about this 50 years. In some ways, there are now generations that are defined by this 50-year mini-constitution, this idea that Hong Kong has freedom of expression, freedom of practice, other things, Facebook, for example, this access to a sort of a global media environment. You know, this is something that is very Hong Kong, is very much part of Hong Kong identity. And this idea that actually maybe these 50 years have somehow been encroached upon or, kind of broken down a little bit or art is being manipulated or, I don't know, diluted in some way, that goes to the heart of a very, very, very concrete fear. And so these protests and the umbrella movement from 2013-14 in Macau too are very much a reflection of this idea that actually these 50 years are sacrosanct. Up until 2047 and 2049, this is how it should be. And so these are, these protests will likely continue if Hong Kong people, if people in Hong Kong feel actually that these 50 years are being stripped away, that the territory is somehow being, brought into China much quicker than the promises that were made. So that's really the scene. And, you know, it's very difficult because actually, at the end of the day, there's a lot of wealthy people in Hong Kong, and Hong Kong is a very wealthy city because of its interconnection with China and Chinese production and manufacturing. So, you know, it's a very symbiotic relationship at the end of the day, which probably makes it all the more difficult. You know, it's like family members, you know, fighting, for example. You know, it's a kind of neighborly conflict, if you like. So, you know, so Hong Kong really does depend on China for its economic survival, but these 50 years are sacrosanct. So heritage then in situations like this becomes very politicized, you know. So the fact that Hong Kong can make a list for itself is quite unique. Why isn't it part of Guangdong region, right? So the Cantonese-speaking region of mainland China. Why isn't Macau and Hong Kong part of that? Why does it have its own list? So even the fact that it does have its list, and the fact that it has complete, decision-making power over how it produces that list and what is on it, is, you know, kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, the authorities have used the full power that they have to make sure that they do express their individuality from mainland China as fully as possible, while also connecting with the fact that, you know, over Guangdong there is a Cantonese opera culture, there is a herbal tea culture, you know, where you can, you know, medicate through kind of hot brews. You know, there's a kind of shared idea of medical, kind of looking after yourself medically through these kinds of things. So they're acknowledging that, but then there's this whole other thing about, you know, actually, but then we're also, you know, heavily seaward looking. You know, we have our special oyster sauces and our fish processed foods and things like this. And of course, we have Hong Kong style dim sum, Hong Kong style milk tea, Hong Kong style, etc. You know, this kind of, this prefix Hong Kong style, you know, it's really quite powerful. And so as a piece of heritage, you know, as a kind of bona fide piece of heritage, it's quite a powerful statement to say, actually, we are very unique in this region, and we should be treated so.
Yeah, you totally touched on all the Hong Kong style foods that I wanted to mention. But so how is, in a very, like, we're talking very kind of big picture, but in like a day-to-day basis, how is food kind of wielded as like a social tool to accept or reject, you know, Chinese government influence or not?
It's interesting. In some ways, I think it's kind of like the kind of competition between restaurants. You know, these, how many Michelin stars can Hong Kong get versus Shanghai, or, you know, what kind of tourists can come to Hong Kong and what kind of money can they spend in Hong Kong compared to Shanghai? Sometimes it's all about, you know, this kind of thing on an everyday basis, just to show that actually, even though Shanghai is very much, you know, on Hong Kong's tail, Hong Kong is still a kind of Chinese and Cantonese cultural powerhouse. You know, they've got the best film industry, they have the best blah, blah, blah. So it's about kind of keeping ahead of the Joneses a little bit as well on an everyday basis, knowing that China is an emerging super and cultural power. But also, I guess it's about acknowledging that there are things in Hong Kong that are just better, better protected in a sense, you know, certain types of Buddhist practices, certain types of temple practices, certain types of festivals and festival foods have had a long and continuous history in Hong Kong compared to, say, in mainland China, where, you know, the Cultural Revolution and other kind of political forces have kind of, if you like, foreshortened or interrupted that history in China, in as much as sometimes these new generation of people who are expressing Buddhist thoughts and reviving Buddhism or Taoism are having to reinvent it in China. Whereas in Hong Kong, there's very much a very, very long tradition of Taoism, for example. So there's a sense that actually they don't have to do much to be different and more powerful and whatever, and more kind of expressive of a certain type of Chineseness, because they simply are, and they exist, and they continue to exist in the same vein. So in some ways, yes, there's a bit of competition, as restaurants do and hotels do and hospitality sectors do, kind of fight to maintain their elite status. And then there's this idea that actually it's okay. we're good. we are who we are, and we've always been this way, and we've never had to apologize or hide that. So there's a kind of power, silent power in that too. Mm-hmm. That is the kind of thing I'm getting anyway.
Yeah. So to close, if you could kind of speak from three different point of views, as someone who's South Asian, as someone who is Cantonese, and as someone who is Chinese, what does it mean to be Chinese today?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's interesting because as a South Asian, I've come across a lot of other South Asians in Hong Kong who have taken, you know, Chinese passports, basically, who have decided, actually, you know, I'm second generation or third generation born here, and I want to live here forever. So this is my identity. So they are largely, you know, Chinese by nationality. And it's all they've known and all, you know, and they are very much committed to Hong Kong. Beyond the 50 years, clearly, right? You know, they're thinking very long term. And so for them, China is a future, is an idea of the future that they are committed to. As it's so difficult to talk in generalizations, but I guess, you know, there are so many different kinds of Cantonese communities in Hong Kong, right? And there are people who have moved since 1997 from mainland China into Hong Kong and are making a good life for themselves there, and look forward to a time after 2047 when things are, you know, pretty much as they expect. And actually some people express the fact that they don't see much difference anymore between Hong Kong and China, and that's a sign of pride for them. Actually, when they go back and forth, they're seeing that Shenzhen and Guangzhou are just as developed as Hong Kong, you know, in these sort of economic terms. So, you know, there are newly arrived Cantonese, relatively, who find Hong Kong just as much of a home, you know, and Chinese-ness then is a bigger category, right? Mm-hmm. So you can be in Hong Kong, you can be in Singapore, you can be in mainland China, and you can still be Chinese, you know, that's their expression of it. So when I researched in Guangzhou and talk to mainland Chinese who do visit Hong Kong quite often, or Singapore, or, you know, they're able to even, you know, get to go to Taipei and things like this. You know, there's a sense actually that there's a heartland issue, and for them, the tables are very much turned. Actually, despite China's political upheavals and this kind of break in traditional Chinese culture, if you like, China remains the heartland for communities in Singapore, in Taipei, in Hong Kong, in Macau. You know, China is the heartland of that. You know, that's where a lot of their kind of Chinese economic power is derived, cultural power is derived. So it's a China that is, I don't know, it's kind of, yeah, beyond territory. It's a kind of greater China feeling, you know? Because I've never grown up in a superpower. Perhaps if you have in the States, you know, you have been and are a superpower. So you kind of, maybe you get an idea of what that feels like. I don't, because Britain's never, I mean, you know, since the Second World War, we've kind of waned in importance. So I've never really felt like I've been part of a superpower. But like when I ask people who are, you know, part of a emerging superpower, you know, they express this in all sorts of confident ways. You know, it's their world, right? You know, they're ready for it. Whether the world's ready for it, I don't know. But, you know, I have to stand back and admire that. I haven't ever felt that. I've always felt a bit apologetic being British in some ways. Babies an American, I don't know, maybe that's different for you. But to be on the cusp of superpowerdom is, I think, they're looking forward to the future in such bright terms, bright ways anyway.
Yeah, I feel like that's a perfect way to end our conversation. I've never thought of myself as part of a superpower, right. And I now think you've blown all the listeners' minds. We're like, am I part of a superpower? So yeah, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Carol.
Meant to be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.